The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Film Show. And this week, the old gang is going back to school. We're hitting the books and learning our trade before graduating to glittering careers, either leaking state secrets or battling leviathans on the ocean floor. But first things first. As usual, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. Up for examination this week, Guillermo del Toro sets out to save the planet in Pacific Rim. Julian Assange has all the information in We Steal Secrets, and Snow White goes to the bullfight in the eccentric silent screen Blancanieves. We begin, though, in the hallowed ivy-clad campus of Monsters University, where the creatures cut their teeth. Pixar's sequel to the wonderful animated Monsters, Inc. again features the voices of Billy Crystal and John Goodman, although this time they've also been joined by Helen Mirren, who plays the spooky head of the college. And sure enough, immediately after morning assembly, the Guardian's Henry Barnes was summoned to the headmistress's office.
Scariness is the true measure of a monster. If you're not scary, what kind of a monster are you?
Helen, how did you research playing a bat-winged centipede-ish insect?
I had to go deep inside myself and pull out that bat-wing, 100-feeted personality that I play.
You know what? It's because I'm English. They're Americans. I'm English. I'm a Brit. I'm British, I should say. You know, they're intimidated and they love us, and at the same time, they're frightened of us.
It's my job to make great students greater, not make mediocre students less mediocre. That is why, at the end of the semester, there will be a final exam. Fail that exam, and you are out of the scaring program.
Why are they frightened of us?
I don't know. Why? You tell me. Why do we always get to play the baddie? You know, why are we the sort of posh, controlling, you know, superior? You know, that's how they see us. Mm. So, you know, when they... John Lasseter said, "I got the role for you." Oh, good, I'm going to be in a Pixar movie. Oh, I see, you want me to be that person. But, you know, you can't escape it.
Okay, I'll lift the bed, you grab the pig. Ready?
What?
One,
no.
Two,
no.
Three!
No.
Ah! Don't let go. Careful, he's a biter.
Yeah!
Whoa, wait. Whoa. I got him!
Uh-oh. Whoa.
That was awesome.
I'm joined now by Henry Barnes and The Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Peter, I loved Monsters, Inc. This one felt like more like a kind of B-side for me.
Yeah. I mean, more and more and more with Pixar movies, I feel like we're on rails. We're on very, very rigid, predetermined rails. It's like a theme park ride. I mean, the way that the screenplay has been constructed, it's so fanatically micromanaged. It looks like a lot of other movies. It looks like every other buddy movie, every other sports movie, every other campus movie. It has a weird similarity to last week's The Internship. It is eerily similar. That's not to say that I didn't like it, because I think you'd have to have a heart of stone in a way not to enjoy it, because it is funny, but it really is predetermined in a way that Monsters, Inc. wasn't. Monsters, Inc. was so left field,
yeah.
People just didn't know what to make of it, and now it's absolutely rigidly laid down.
Henry, did the magic work for you?
It did, partly. I think it's funny to talk about there being a golden age of Pixar only like 10 years after it happened.
Yeah.
But it is, in a strange way, like they've set up these characters in those golden films like Ratatouille or Monsters, Inc., which are classics, I think, modern classics. It doesn't matter if they're animation or not.
Oh, yeah.
And now you have this thing where they're making a franchise out of the same characters in quite a boring setting, really. You know, you've seen all the tropes that are shown here before in the American university environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the interesting thing about Monsters, Inc. for me was that it was a dull workplace. You were in their everyday life, and they had exciting exciting jobs, but they were on the factory floor. And now you're thrown back to the classically supposed to be exciting time of university life.
Frat boys,
even more boring.
And hazing.
Yeah.
And the first film, it was very much they were both blue collar guys going to their job.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you're suddenly told that Sully is the son of a great scarer, and he's like kind of royalty.
Yeah.
And the only thing that Wazowski can do as a member of the lower class is be his kind of assistant and help him out. And it felt like I was watching, you know, the early years of George Bush and Karl Rove.
Yeah.
The college days.
Yeah.
And it just felt that's not what the first film was about.
No, they weren't privileged. They weren't an elite. Whereas this is about sort of the elite, the college elite. It looks like, it doesn't look like any old college either. It looks like Princeton. It really does.
Yeah. So, Henry, if we've now come off the back of the golden age of Pixar, is this now them coming down with sequelitis? Is this now them being just another studio and cranking out the franchises?
It might well be that. I think it's maybe also that Pixar is now looking for that next generation of writers, directors, and perhaps animators to bring those brand new, fresh stories to the stable as well. You've got people like Brad Bird, Dan Scanlon, who did this. He's quite new to it, but Brad Bird went off and did the Mission Impossible films, got into live action. And without those defining voices, I think it's difficult to make characters and to make stories that become as endemic in our culture as something like Monsters, Inc. or even Ratatouille did. So it might be a case that they're just waiting for the new class to come through, and when they do that, we'll get great Pixar movies again.
Mm, I know. You're a princess and I'm just a stable boy.
Mm. Yeah! Mom! What are you doing?
Your grubby paw was in my bed!
Were you kissing my hand?
No, and what about you with all your shedding?
I don't shed.
Really?
That's Monsters University, a film to make us love the monster and accept him as our friend. But what about if we hate the monster, if we want to kill the monster and squash him and fry him with rockets? For those people, there is always Pacific Rim.
Guillermo del Toro's heavy metal 3D blockbuster gives us the Kraken from the deep, along with vast man-made killing machines. It then has the Kraken from the deep and the machines fight one another, sometimes in the water and sometimes on the land. Oil tankers get used as cudgels and entire cities are laid to waste. Will no one put an end to this never-ending carnage?
Henry, whose side were you on in this, the robot or the monster?
I wanted to be on Del Toro's side, but I wasn't by the end of it. I thought this was big and brash and really boring by the end of the 2.5 hours I think we spent watching robots and monsters bash chunks out of each other. It reminded me a little bit of Starship Troopers without it being camp enough or funny enough or silly enough to really be that entertaining, or indeed bloody enough. It's not, there's no, as Peter said in his review, there's mass destruction of all these cities, but there's no indication that hundreds of thousands of people might have actually died on screen.
Well, there's a lot of talk of evacuating the cities beforehand, that the cities then get
it's
kind of laid to waste.
Efficient evacuation procedure, isn't it? In the space of a few hours, everybody's out.
Well, even like a few minutes, because the thing just kind of comes out of the ocean, and then everyone's in a bunker while the city gets kind of torn apart.
But the key moment of this film for me was there's a bit where they have different categories of kaiju, which are the monsters that they have to fight, and they have a Category 5 kaiju, which is supposed to be hundreds of feet tall, and it comes up out the screen, and you can't tell if it's any bigger than any of the monsters you've seen before, because the scale of the film up to that point has been so grandiose and overblown that adding another layer on top just completely fails to blow it out the water, I thought.
It's like the amp that goes up to 11.
Yeah.
Peter, did it blow out the levels for you?
No, I just felt that the humans and the monsters and the robots had all gone to the same acting school that removes personality. Mm. And that all three of them are as boring as each other. I've never been more baffled or more bored for a long time, really, especially if it's Guillermo del Toro. Now, I've been kind of agnostic a bit about Guillermo del Toro in the past, but where was the flavour?
Yeah.
Where was the signature, the sense that you're being told a story? Where was, you know, where was the sense that it was the work of somebody who made Hellboy or Blade 2 or on a different level, Pan's Labyrinth?
Absolutely nothing like that, except, I think, when someone like Ron Perlman comes on, and you would think, wow, you know, they
it's
don't have to
like
be boring.
He's from a different film.
He's from a different film. He's from a Guillermo del Toro film. He suddenly comes on and he's kind of funny and smart and stylish. And then he goes and we're back to Charlie Hunnam, you know, who is frankly as dull as ditchwater. It's unbelievable.
But I think someone like Ron Perlman actually looks monstrous.
Yeah,
in his
exactly.
own way as well. And he that's why he brings that spice to the
screen. He looks like a kind of player. He looks like he's going to do or say something interesting. Whereas nobody at all, nobody from any species level, gives you any comparable assurance. It's just terrible.
But I had the sense that that was the film that probably he did want to make. There is this, in Maybe. The wings, there's the strange Ron Perlman character, there's the sense of this kind of doomsday cult that is worshipping these beasts from the deep. And you think, now that's an interesting kind of
interesting.
Aside.
It would have been
And yet all of that is cleared away in favour of all these kind of thunderous, endless battles.
Yeah, and they are so dull. And there's a moment at the beginning where they very cheekily diss Transformers, a kid looking for stuff on the beach. He's kind of a beach guy, picks up some rusty old Transformer and goes, oh, why can't we find anything good? Frankly, that's a rather ungracious treatment of a film franchise to which this thing is indebted. You know, it's ripping off Transformers, effectively. And not, I never thought I'd hear myself praise Transformers, but, oh, my God. I mean, at least it had something, in a way, it had a tang of something, which, funnily enough, I think this doesn't have.
But what I think this does have is that, particularly with the action scenes, there is a sense of place and of location, of the physicality of the fight, whereas with Transformers, everything was so frantic and so fast. Mm. The editing was off the wall loopy that you couldn't tell exactly what was hitting what and where they were supposed to be going. I think the action sequences in this are fantastic. I'm just not sure that... It's that weird irony that you have to pay 10 to 15 quid to go and watch this in its full splendour, but I would never recommend that someone pay 10 to 15 quid to watch this for the storyline.
And there aren't very many action sequences. There isn't much compared to the long, boringly acted, boringly directed character journeys.
And this weird love triangle.
The love triangle and
so
Idris
tedious.
Elba's boring kind of daddy-daughter relationship with one of them. Who cares? Mm. It's so boring.
The edge of our hope, at the end of our time, we have chosen to believe in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
The cacophonous Pacific Rim there. There was a time when we looked to Guillermo del Toro for rich, strange, wild new cinema. These days, though, we must look to Blancanieves.
If you only see one silent screen version of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, shot in black and white and set amid the bullrings of 1900 Spain, well, then it simply has to be Blancanieves. It's directed by Pablo Berger. It stars Macarena Garcia as Snow White. And the dwarfs are here recast as a band of travelling matadors.
Peter, shockingly, neither Henry or I have seen this, and I'm kicking myself now.
I thought it was absolutely terrific, absolutely brilliant. It's this little film which first surfaced, I think, at the San Sebastian Film Festival last year, and a small but diehard band of film bloggers and writers who'd seen it kept the ball rolling, kept going on and on and on about this until I think it went to the London Film Festival, and now it's been picked up by one of the big distributors, and it's got a release now. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a black and white silent movie, a retelling of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs set in southern Spain in 1910. And for a lot of people, you know, the idea of another black and white silent movie, that's a bit of an outrageous film buff thing to like, especially so soon after The Artist. And I understand and appreciate that reservation. But it is absolutely sublime. It's really funny. It's kind of lighter than air. All its little touches seem to be achieved so effortlessly. It is made with such style and such brilliance in a way. There are little allusions to other filmmakers like Buñuel and Browning and Hitchcock. And these are managed sort of thrown away so lightly and so airily that you can sort of think, well, I didn't mind that at all. I don't even recognise it as an illusion.
It's interesting because you're saying it's so light, but all these references are pretty dark. They from are. Bunuel to actual bullfighting.
Oh, yes. Well, it is. Yes, it's not encumbered by any modern correct sense that bullfighting is wrong, by no means.
Right.
It's almost like Gladiator,
it's
basically.
Like, woohoo!
Yeah, it's sort of woohoo, but in the same sense that Gladiator was woohoo about human beings being killed in the ring, in the Colosseum, in a way. And the final gladiatorial scene, where the daughter has to face up to a terrifyingly large bull, it's just brilliant. It is just terrifically good.
Snow White and the Bull in Blancanieves. We end altogether closer to home with We Steal Secrets, Alex Gibney's documentary about WikiLeaks. And, wouldn't you know it, The Guardian has a walk-on role.
There was material which could get people hurt, Julian said. If an Afghan civilian helps occupying forces, he deserves to die.
They might already have on their hands the blood of some young soldier.
Scared the hell out of a lot of people. How are we going to stop it? And how far has it gone already?
The sort of aging student Herbert was a rock star.
Oscar-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney ventures behind the headlines with his examination of Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, and all that. We Steal Secrets is a crash course in the politics of WikiLeaks and whistleblowers. Gibney leads us from Assange's embryonic beginnings, hacking NASA computers in the 1980s, right through to the deluge of diplomatic cables and classified documents that shook the world in 2010.
Nation states need to be secret in order to be successful. We steal secrets.
Henry, did this tell you more about WikiLeaks than you had any wish to know?
I'm not sure it told me more about WikiLeaks. It might have told me more about Bradley Manning. That, not that I wish to know, but that I wanted to know, actually. I thought it was great in that regard. And this is first out of the gate of the 7,000 WikiLeaks films that are coming down the pipeline. But it's a decent, solid retelling of the recent events, as much as you could expect for something that is so close to the time period that it's talking about, I think. The part that I loved about it was that the way that he talks about Bradley Manning, but we don't ever really see Bradley Manning much for the first hour or so. You instead get these chat transcripts that Bradley Manning sent to his contact. A lot of films have trouble showing the internet or email or chat transcripts as something that's exciting, but I did find this weirdly moving, just seeing this type rattle across the screen as he talks about his gender identification problems and the trouble he's having in the military. So I thought it was great for that reason. The other side of it, dealing with Assange, was a little bit overblown for me in that he paints him as something of a fool by the end of it, I felt. And it was a little bit disingenuous to Assange in terms of the risk that he personally has taken as well. He might well be into the showbiz aspect of being a hacktivist, but at the same time, you have to give the guy credit, and I think the film tears him down a little bit too much.
Assange has publicly disowned the film and has many issues with it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was an interesting film. I think Henry's absolutely right. But the problem for me, I'm not sure there's a problem, but it's a slight issue that it rather smoothly and even glibly takes the party line against Assange. It just says, well, he was a fascinating radical, a wild, fascinating, anarchic and subversive. But in the end, he's flawed. In the end, he's a paranoid authoritarian. So we can sort of dismiss him a bit. I think, well, yes, he is a nasty piece of work, possibly, and he may be a bit of a big head, but that applies to a lot of journalists too, incidentally. But he achieved something kind of staggering. He achieved this extraordinary revelation. He had to be both journalist and source himself, because his anonymous Dropbox meant that he genuinely didn't know who'd given him this information. It wasn't him who'd dropped Bradley Manning, it was somebody else. I mean, in all the narratives about journalistic scoops, there's always a question, oh, do we burn our source? Do we give away our source? Genuinely, that wasn't the case now.
But that is an issue with Assange, that he is utterly irresponsible.
But he is irresponsible, yes, that's true. But that's because he genuinely is an outsider. He doesn't have media ethics. I think he was learning on the job in a way that lots of us do. And I think the question that I sat down to this movie with, is John Pilger going to be interviewed here or not? Are we going to get the case for Julian Assange? No. And I think it was kind of disingenuous. Whatever you think of John Pilger, John Pilger is a very vehement, very angry person who is in Assange's corner. He thinks that the conventional, bland, consensual, liberal
media have dropped Assange. They have betrayed Assange. Now, whether you agree with that or not,
I think you need to hear it.
I think we needed to hear from John Pilger, and we didn't.
Are we too close to this material? Is it too current? Is Gibney able to frame it, or is this a kind of work in progress?
I think, in some ways, we aren't close enough to what it's been about in the first place. Why have they risked their lives to tell us what exactly? Now, what they told us is that the civilian casualties and the attitude to civilian casualties and collateral damage in Iraq and Afghanistan was far higher than the authorities ever pretended to us. And also that the United States has a dysfunctional relationship now with Pakistan, that it showers them with aid and it showers them with drones. And there's this weird, creepy thing happening. And without Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, we wouldn't know as much about that or anything about that. So I think I could have done with more of the political context from the film. That's not to disparage it, because I thought it was very decently done and it was very thorough.
And in that regard, it would be interesting to see what the fictionalised version, which is coming out, I think, next year, with Benedict Cumberbatch starring as Assange, will do with it, because we're still incredibly close to the events as they happen.
Yes, exactly.
And you're going to add that layer of drama on top.
Yes.
I worry that we're going to be looking back on this as an absolute mess.
This is, yeah. Who's going to be playing the Ecuadorian president? Ron Perlman. Yeah.
Frankly, I just didn't find what he had to say all that interesting at first, until he started making references to spilling secrets.
We Steal Secrets, bringing this week's show to Deadline and beyond. My thanks to Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. My thanks to you, particularly you, for watching. We're back again on the couch next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.